This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Karen Kassler, State House Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio and Television, and I'm sitting in for Marianne Zalesnik. The fate of the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark 1973 decision, Roe v. Wade, hangs in the balance. The High Court is deliberating on a Mississippi law banning abortions after 15 weeks. Meanwhile, lawmakers at the state and even local levels in Ohio have introduced and sometimes passed their own restrictive anti-abortion measures. Among them, a new law that could shutter Southwest Ohio's two remaining clinics that provide abortions. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss what comes next and what is at stake are Dr. Michelle Goodwin. She's the University of California Irvine School of Law Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy Director. She's also the author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Welcome, Dr. Goodwin.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Also joining us is Dr. Jen Dye, University of Cincinnati College of Law, Nathaniel R. Jones Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice Director. Welcome, Dr. Dye.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Dr. Michelle McGowan. She is the University of Cincinnati Departments of Pediatric and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Research Associate Professor. Welcome, Dr. McGowan.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have questions or comments, you can join our conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can send us a tweet. So let's get started here, and I want to start with Dr. Goodwin, the U.S. Supreme Court currently deliberating the constitutionality of a law in Mississippi that would ban abortions 15 weeks after conception. So you're the expert on this here. Can you run us through the basics of this case and what is at stake for the precedent that was set back in 1973 with Roe versus Wade?
Thank you for that question. So on December 1st, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case called Dobbs. This is a case that involves a Mississippi abortion ban. It bans abortions after 15 weeks, as you said, after conception, and it makes no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. And this case directly challenges the framework of Roe v. Wade and also Planned Parenthood v. Casey. The Supreme Court said in 1973, in a 7-2 opinion, that the state had no real interest in intervening in pregnancy decisions prior to the viability of a fetus. Now, when exactly is viability? Most have thought that that's sometime within the third trimester, although that too is contested. Some would say viability is when a baby is actually born and can survive, and you don't really know when that's going to be, save for interfering with the autonomy of the person who's carrying the pregnancy. What this case does is that it challenges that framework, and if the Supreme Court does allow the Mississippi law to go into effect, that essentially triggers 26 other states that would have laws that are similar. Now, it's worth noting that this law, even though it was signed by the governor into effect, has not gone into effect because Judge Carlton Reeves, who is a district court judge in Mississippi, imposed an injunction saying that the law was unconstitutional, it contravened Roe, and in quite a robust opinion, including in stunning footnotes, he spoke about the history of sexism and racism in the state of Mississippi, because the state of Mississippi defended the law, saying that this was about protecting the health, the interest of women. And in his injunction, Judge Reeves essentially questioned how could the state of Mississippi say that this was about protecting the health and safety of women when Mississippi has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the country. It's actually safer to terminate a pregnancy than it is to carry a pregnancy to term, especially in the state of Mississippi.
Now, before we get to those 26 other states with trigger laws, I want to ask you, Dr. Goodwin, Mississippi is not the only state that has pursued recent abortion restrictions contested at the U.S. Supreme Court. Texas also landed in the High Court for restrictions it passed last year. That's a different case. So what are those restrictions about, and what is the Supreme Court doing with them? What are the implications of that case?
Well, that's a stunning case because that case shows us just how fragile right now the rule of law is. The Supreme Court has the lowest opinion rating of the public that it's had in more than 50 years. So let me tell you about the case and why that matters. That case involves a 6-week abortion ban at a time in which most people wouldn't even know, women, girls wouldn't know that they are pregnant. Additionally, it provides no exceptions for rape or incest. And it's important to know that that is a strange feature of the these laws. It's something that one would never have seen even 10 years ago from the most vocal anti-abortion proponents. That law also does two other things that have captured international attention. One is that it provides a bounty for people who want to sue individuals who aid and abet other people with terminating a pregnancy. This could be family members, it could be an Uber driver, it could be a receptionist, anybody. The law is written just that broadly, that anybody who counsels, assists, however, in the termination of a pregnancy could be sued and could recover at least $10,000. Additionally, what the law does is it says that, well, there's no one in the state, a state official, who can enforce the law, which is why the law became so entangled in a kind of procedural morass, in that it leaves it to citizens to enforce. Those citizens who seek to enforce the law can also recover attorney's fees. This kind of draconian aspect of the law reminds many of fugitive slave laws, which were quite similar, allowing individuals to track, surveil other people, and essentially receive a bounty from the state. Now, this case came before the United States Supreme Court. Many people thought that the case would be struck down because it directly challenges the fundamental nature of Roe v. Wade. But interestingly, the Supreme Court has shifted in terms of its makeup, and in a case that was stunning in terms of dissent, because the Chief Justice, who is not necessarily a proponent of abortion rights, sided with the liberals on the court. So in a 5-4 decision, this law has essentially been allowed to be in effect, meaning that Roe v. Wade, as far as people would typically know it, is now off the books in the state of Texas. What the Supreme Court has allowed is that people in Texas who are harmed by the law may sue a state official in their individual capacity.
I want to bring this down to the state level here, and I want to bring in Dr. McGowan and Dr. Dye on this. The legislature has been quite interested in abortion legislation over the last probably 10 years or so. And I want to ask you, one of the things that has been passed is this so-called trigger law. What are some of the other pieces of legislation that people need to be aware of? And I'll throw that out to either Dr. Dye or Dr. McGowan.
Well, I'll start. This is Dr. McGowan. You know, the trigger ban in Ohio is not in effect yet. It is being considered at the state level. And if it were to go into effect after, you know, the Supreme Court makes a decision around the Dobbs case, it could mean that driving distance to access an abortion for Ohioans would increase for people in 85 out of Ohio's 88 counties. And the reason for that 85 is that for some people, the closest abortion clinic is already out of state in Pennsylvania. So people traveling from mid and southwestern Ohio counties in particular could expect to have a really large increase in travel distance to seek abortion out of the state, up to 300 miles each way to access care. We know that further distance is associated with increased cost and travel time, which could delay access to abortion care and prevent some people from being able to access abortion care at all.
Let's talk about the Southwest Ohio connection here. The most recent law that was signed, this is a piece of legislation that could lead to the closure of clinics in Cincinnati and Dayton. And let me ask you both, can you tell me a little bit about that? Why specifically are those two clinics potentially going to be affected by the most recent piece of legislation that was signed last month by Governor DeWine after it had passed both the House and the Senate?
This is Dr. Dye. I'll go ahead and chime in here. So you're referring to, it was Senate Bill 157, and Governor DeWine signed that in, I think, right before Christmas. And it will take effect, I believe, sometime in the spring. And essentially, the bill basically says that any fetuses that survive abortions are to be provided life-saving care. And the impact here, especially in Southwest Ohio, and that would be the Women's Medical Center in Dayton and the Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio, is that already those facilities that provide abortions have to have agreements called to allow basically hospital care for those people that they treat. So these two clinics in particular have variances where they basically have agreements with physicians who have admitting care into local hospitals. So they don't have the agreement with the hospital, but with physicians that have agreements with the hospital. So it's sort of an exception there. And this piece of legislation in particular basically says that if you don't have a transfer agreement, then you can't operate. So it could really make it difficult for them to operate and provide care.
Yeah, and this is Senate Bill 157. Like you mentioned, it takes effect on March 21st. And it should be stated here that this has been kind of a problem in a solution in search of a problem, in that there really hasn't been a circumstance that this particular piece of legislation sought to correct. I mean, this doesn't happen, right?
Correct. The piece of the legislation that pertains to providing life-saving care for post-abortion doesn't apply to abortion clinics. It could complicate care in other kinds of healthcare settings. The vast majority of abortions, though, take place in freestanding clinics. And I'd just like to add one thing to Dr. Dye's comment, which is to suggest that the question around clinic closure is messy here, because the variants that these clinics in Southwest Ohio have are for their surgical facility licenses. So it's not necessarily that the clinics would close per se if they have to comply with the Senate Bill 157, but rather that they may have to scale back the kinds of services that they provide and only provide medication abortion if they can't maintain a surgical license, surgical facility license. And so it contributes to what we have called abortion care churn, which is that it creates a lot of instability and potential complications for patients being able to access care and to know where care is available if they're seeking abortion services in the state.
Karen, I'd like to jump in here,
sure,
if that's
sure.
Okay. And that is, you raised a really important question about these laws that we've seen emerge across the United States in search of a problem. And I think that that's worth noting. Between 2010 and 2013, there were more anti-abortion laws that were proposed and enacted than the 30 years prior. And I think if we level set, even thinking about the Supreme Court, state legislatures, in 1973, when Roe was a 7-2 opinion, 5 of those 7 justices were Republican appointed. Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion in Roe, was actually put on the court by Richard Nixon. And so I say that because as you ask that question, it's what is going on here? Why have we seen this onslaught and these laws if, in fact, we know that an abortion, a person is 14 times more likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than by terminating it? The World Health Organization has said that abortion is as safe as a penicillin shot. So if this isn't really about health and safety, if it's not really about protecting the health and safety of women and girls, if we know these high maternal mortality rates exist, then what are these laws for? And I think that that's an important question that we must ask ourselves.
Great. And when you bring up the number of pieces of legislation that have been proposed in the current General Assembly, which started this year, 5 have been proposed so far, 9 in the last session, 8 in the session before that. Not all of them, of course, passed, but it does give you an indication that this is a topic that the legislature is quite interested in. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Karen Kassler. The Supreme Court may be on the verge of curtailing abortion rights in the United States and upholding a Mississippi law that violates one of the essential holdings of Roe v. Wade, established nearly 50 years ago. What could this mean as Ohio lawmakers have introduced, and in some cases passed their own, restrictive anti-abortion measures? Again, there are 5 that have been proposed in the General Assembly so far this session, which started last year. And there were 9 last session, 8 the session before. They've definitely been putting some of that abortion legislation out there. So I want to reintroduce our guests. Joining us are University of California Irvine School of Law, Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy Director, Dr. Michelle Goodwin. She's also the author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Welcome, Dr. Goodwin, again.
Thank you.
Also, we have on the line Dr. Jen Dye. She's University of Cincinnati College of Law, Nathaniel R. Jones Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice Director. Welcome, Dr. Dye.
Thank you.
And Dr. Michelle McGowan. She is University of Cincinnati Departments of Pediatrics and Women's Gender and Sexuality Study Research Associate Professor. Welcome again, Dr. McGowan.
Thank you.
So let's pick up where we left off with that question out there of what are all these pieces of legislation about? These are laws that are popping up in multiple states and even at the local level in some cases. And I want to throw that question out there. What are these laws about? I think Dr. Goodwin, you had brought up the question. So maybe Dr. Yes. McGowan or Dr. Guy could weigh in on that.
Sure, I'd be happy to weigh in. I mean, ultimately, these laws are about controlling the autonomy of people who have the capacity to become pregnant. And there have been several decisions that have come down from the Supreme Court that have suggested that curtailing that autonomy is a breach of our values as a society. However, this hasn't stopped the state legislatures from trying to control reproductive autonomy when trying to maintain liberty in other areas, such as avoiding vaccine or mask mandates in the state to avoid COVID transmission. So there seems to be this dual approach of curtailing autonomy in some spaces and trying to promote it in others in state legislatures. But I would love to hear what Dr. Dye here thinks as well.
Thank you. Yeah, I would just echo what you said. I mean, clearly, I think what Dr. Goodwin and Dr. McGowan have pointed out is that, you know, there's clearly not a risk to health or safety here, right? And so what this comes down to is essentially being able to exercise control over a person who can get pregnant, autonomy and liberty. And it's interesting because Roe v. Wade was originally sort of the opinion there was shaped on this right to privacy and the infringement on the right to liberty. So it definitely is creating this duality where, you know, there's a right to privacy and liberty, but only in certain areas. And it raises questions of who decides what those areas are, and how far that goes. And I'm sure, you know, I know you alluded to the second half of the show, but the right to privacy also expands into, you know, access to contraceptives and the other areas like same-sex relationships. So this is a very, it's a far-reaching, broad, implicating issue.
If you have questions or comments, you can join in our conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU, or you can send us a tweet, and we'd love to hear conversations. We'd love to have anybody else join our conversation here. It's not just laws at the state level now. We're also seeing laws at the local level that have been proposed, including two in Southwest Ohio. Lebanon and Mason, I believe, both enacted proposals that sought to deal with abortion in some way. Can you explain, any one of you explain exactly how that works and why that would be something that municipalities would want to do in a state that already seems to be headed that direction anyway?
Sure. So these city ordinances are meant to create abortion-free zones at the local level. I'd like to state that both passed, both in Lebanon and in Mason. However, with the reconstitution of the post-election Mason City Council, this was recently overturned. But, you know, in many ways, this is sort of an unrealistic set of regulations in the sense that neither of these municipalities have abortion clinics, but it could be these pieces of these ordinances are modeled after Texas SB 8 in the sense that those who seek abortions and those who facilitate seeking abortions, such as driving someone to an abortion provider in another city in the state or out of state, could be implicated by these particular pieces of legislation. So in many ways, they seem like they're trying to show ideological commitments to curtailing reproductive liberty and individual privacy, but they don't have a lot of teeth in the sense that there are no providers in those particular spaces. So they are signaling a commitment more than being able to enact on them.
Anyone else want to add in anything on that?
Well, I would only say two things. That one, the model that we saw coming out of the state of Texas was a blueprint, and it reflected not a sprint, but a marathon in terms of ideological shifting, right? It gave a blueprint for any other kind of state legislature or local government seeking to upend abortion rights and to do it in such a way that would really handcuff those who are harmed by the law and seeking to appeal to justice. The other thing that I would say is important that we understand is that these are efforts that are not taken in isolation. In the very same states where we have seen anti-abortion lawmaking and in local municipalities where we've seen this kind of thing, we've also seen voter suppression and we've seen gerrymandering. And it's the same pattern that we saw between 2010 and 2013. So it would be a significant blind spot if we did not connect the efforts to suppress abortion rights also go along in the same states where there are efforts to suppress voting rights, which is key to our democracy and rule of law. And I would say that another rail of that is then how women of color are affected by this. So let's be clear that those who have been most harmed in the United States by maternal mortality have been Black and brown women. Black women are 3.5 times more likely nationally to die from maternal mortality than their white counterparts. But let's also be clear that the United States does a terrible job with keeping pregnant persons alive. It ranks between 50th and 54th in the world in terms of maternal mortality. It's safer to give birth in Saudi Arabia than it is in the United States. And that is dramatically experienced and felt in the states that have done the most robust anti-abortion lawmaking. So to keep the conversation as nuanced as we possibly can, we must be aware of those intersections and what they represent.
One of the things I found interesting in a year-end interview I did with Governor Mike DeWine, who has always identified as being very strongly pro-life, very anti-abortion, when I talked to both the House and Senate leaders about further restrictions on abortion rights, they said, you know, banning abortion is a good idea, according to Senate President Matt Huffman, and House Speaker Bob Kupp is alongside that as well. But DeWine himself said that he doesn't feel that that's going to resolve the issue. A total ban on abortion wouldn't resolve the issue. He said it's going to continue no matter what because other states will do other different things. And he says those who oppose abortion have to reach out to people who are pregnant early on. Is that kind of a radical stance from somebody who has been so deeply working on anti-abortion issues for a long time?
I don't know that I would say it's radical. It may be pragmatic. And in the sense that we know that whether abortion is legal or not, it will continue. By making it less legal, we potentially make it less safe. And so I don't know what's behind the governor's comments specifically, but it may be a recognition that there were over 20,000 abortions recorded in the state of Ohio in the last year. This is consistent with many of the recent years. And it's unrealistic to expect that that number would drop to zero if abortion was made illegal. So I'll be curious to see what happens going forward. But I don't know that I would say it's radical so much as a recognition of reality.
Yeah, I mean, we've banned murder, essentially, and yet murders happen every day. So the idea of just enacting a piece of legislation, then somehow that's going to stop the act, that's not realistic, I guess, is it?
No, it's not realistic. And I think if we hark back to Roe v. Wade and read that opinion written by Justice Blackmun, as he explained, abortions were not always criminalized in the United States. In fact, abortions had been legal in the United States up until around the time of the Civil War. And I think it's worth noting that when abortions became a political issue the first time around in the United States, it was around the time of the Civil War, and the individuals who were pushing for the criminalization of abortion were the very people trying to push women out of gynecological care. These were people like Dr. Horatio Storer, Dr. Joseph D. Lee. These were people who are writing pamphlets, albeit some called them books, that said that women were unsanitary, you know, who cared for women patients, that women were not smart enough as men were to be able to care in the reproductive space. It was very clear a campaign that one was quite sexist, trying to remove women from reproductive health care, as women had been about 100% of the midwives in the country. And at the same time, it was quite racist, because what they also wrote is that they needed white women to spread their loins all across the country to fight against what was coming, which was the release of Black people from American slavery. If we're not aware of that history, then it's really hard to put in context than what it is that we're seeing today. The fights against abortion liberty, or the right to be able to control one's own reproductive health, have often come from spaces that have nothing to do with actually protecting the interest of women or people who can become pregnant, but really have been about power and control, and also money, to be quite honest.
Any final thoughts from Dr. McGowan, Dr. Dye, as we get ready to close this segment? I guess not. All right. Well, I really appreciate our guests here on the show, Dr. Michelle Goodwin, University of California, Irvine School of Law, Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy Director. Thank you, Dr. Goodwin.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being with you today.
Great. Dr. Jen Dye, University of Cincinnati, College of Law, Nathaniel R. Jones, Center for Race, Gender and Social Justice Director. Dr. Dye, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Michelle McGowan, she is the University of Cincinnati Departments of Pediatrics and Women's Gender and Sexuality Study Research Associate Professor. Thanks so much for your time, Dr. McGowan.
Thanks for hosting this conversation.